Are we missing somebody for FELA?
Here she is. Here she is.
No, looks like we're okay.
Oh, there we go. Okay.
If it please the court, good afternoon. My name is Flora Edwards, and I represent the appellant. With the court's permission, the first issue that I would like to address is the recall of the mandate. I'm aware of the recent decision of this court in Carrington on September 11th of this year. But I'm also aware that in Carrington, this court did not hold that relief would never be available in a particular case based on a showing of extraordinary circumstances. And the court set forth a two-part test for extraordinary circumstances.
Counsel, do you plan to focus mainly on this sentence issue, or do you want to talk about whether he should get relief on the merits because of the conflict?
I would like to spend my time just at the beginning to very briefly go through the sentence issue, if the court would permit me to do so, Your Honor.
Whatever. I have some questions about the conflict, and maybe we'll get to them, maybe not.
Well, I'll do this real, real quick. The two-part test, the evidence that the appellant was uniquely impacted by the guidelines and other inequities which distinguished that particular defendant from other defendants before Booker. And Fiorillo really meets both tests. This is Fiorillo's first felony offense. He and his co-defendant Flowers, and Flowers had a criminal history category of 4, and according to the government, he's the leader of the entire organization. Fiorillo ends up, because of the way they configured the conspiracy with a guideline calculation, Flowers ends up with a guideline calculation that's marginally lower than Fiorillo. They both argue on appeal that the determination of the drug quantity by the court at sentencing violates Apprendi. This court agreed and holds under the guideline that you have to apply the stacking provision. So then the court applies Archdale and holds that because Flowers had not been sentenced to the bottom of the guidelines, notwithstanding the fact that the court thought that that was the appropriate sentence, he was entitled to be resentenced. But Fiorillo, who was sentenced to the bottom of the higher range, only because the court very clearly said he was compelled to do so by the guidelines, wasn't entitled to be resentenced. Flowers is resentenced with all the due process afforded by Apprendi, and he leaves the two co-defendants on exactly the same facts in the same trial with very, very different results. One defendant gets convicted and sentenced with all the due process afforded by Apprendi.
May I interrupt it, because I may be able to accelerate this. And you're relying on the Carrington case?
The last Carrington case.
The second one?
The second one,
okay,
yes.
So I want to make sure that we're on the same page.
We're on, absolutely. The September 11th, 2007 case, this very recent case. All the due process, he gets all the due process, and the other gets to languish in prison in the interests of finality. This even goes back to this court's 1992 decision in Walter, and I just wanted to say that really, really quickly so that the court could hear this. It is, if that's not a manifest injustice, Your Honor, I don't know what is. Anyway, now I'll be very happy to talk about the conflict of interest that I want.
In the reduced time you have left.
Yes, Your Honor.
The test under Kyler is whether some plausible defense strategy or tactic might have been pursued but was not, and that the alternative defense was inherently in conflict with or not undertaken due to the attorney's other loyalties or interests. There has to be a demonstration that an actual conflict of interest adversely affected his attorney's performance. Now, I tried to take the facts of this case and put them into that rule. And concretely, I'm having trouble doing it. I can think of several possibilities. One is Snero or Tony Serra would have gotten Fiorillo to snitch out Flowers in exchange for a deal. But there's no argument. There's no proffer of evidence that he would have. There's no affidavit that he would have pleaded. There's no affidavit that a deal was available. No, nothing. Another possibility that I think was argued was he would have cross-examined Flowers more aggressively. But he couldn't cross-examine Flowers anyway because he didn't testify. And the third possibility is he would have asked the FBI agent who was the Los Angeles supplier. What did the informant tell you about the Los Angeles supplier? But most of us, well, I learned at my father's knee, never ask a question you don't know the answer to on cross. And I think most of us who've defended criminal cases know that. FBI, he probably didn't ask it because he was afraid the FBI agent would blast him. After that, I run out of ideas for how the conflict could have been actual as opposed to speculative.
If I may, Your Honor, I've got a fourth alternative. This investigation started, let me back up. Flowers was represented by Sarah, Tony Sarah, from 1990 to 1992. In that same period, the government, according to the PSR, was investigating Flowers in this case. And they had decided, the government, by 1991, which is precisely the period in which Sarah's representing him, that Flowers had the head of this great organization which controlled the whole Oakland cocaine market, and he shared it with somebody named Lacey. We also find out that during this period, Flowers has a separate supplier of cocaine in Los Angeles. Now, what Sarah does is he moves to get the information regarding the informant so he can develop an independent source. But he can't do that. Well, what else could he do? He can move for severance.
Fat chance. Cocaine conspiracy case, you're going to get a severance for one of the co-conspirators? Good luck.
Well, Your Honor, I can think of dozens of cases in almost all the circuits where the circuit has held that the prediction that that might not work is not a reason not to pursue that strategy.
I don't actually even remember the argument. Maybe it's in there somewhere, that because of his conflict of interest, he didn't move for a severance, nor do I understand exactly why he wouldn't.
Why he wouldn't move for a severance?
Why the fact that he had represented Flowers during a critical period would deter Tony Sarah from moving for a continuance for Fiorillo.
Well, if he had moved for a severance, and if Flower had either testified voluntarily or under subpoena.
Why would he do that?
Why would he do that?
Incriminate himself?
No, if Flower's case goes first, then he is no longer in jeopardy for that particular conspiracy. But in any event, I can think of a number of cases, and I'm sorry I don't have the case in the Ninth Circuit, where the prediction that someone might assert his Fifth Amendment right does not constitute newly discovered evidence. It's not an excuse not to call them. If you believe that you need them, you should be able to do that. Tony Sarah doesn't get the transcript from the in-camera hearing. We still don't have that transcript. He doesn't get the transcript. He doesn't pursue it.
Once he wasn't allowed to, was he?
Oh, after the case was over, he could have done it on appeal. He could have, after he looked at it, had he not been convicted.
The whole idea of the in-camera hearing is, while he's defending Fiorillo, it's secret from him. Now, after the case is over, that's
but
a different story.
He could have reopened on a Rule 33, Your Honor. In other words, had there been evidence that he could have presented, the problem is that he couldn't present that evidence because the moment he presents the evidence, he is in a world of conflicting loyalties to his former client. He can't question.
What evidence are you referring to?
The evidence that Flowers, indeed, if the government's allegation is correct, was the major supplier of cocaine. And if he was the major supplier of cocaine, of cocaine, and if he was that major distributor of cocaine, then he had a supplier. And that supplier was in Los Angeles, and that supplier was not Fiorillo.
And what evidence do you have that supplier was not Fiorillo?
Well, I think the evidence that we have is that we have an informant A,
yes,
who talks about the supplier.
Right.
There is nothing in any record that ties Fiorillo to anything south of San Francisco.
The judge found that informant A really was not a percipient witness and wouldn't have added anything.
Well, That is what the court said, but then the problem is that Sarah couldn't explore it any further. He couldn't explore it with Agent Broderick. He couldn't ask for
habeas,
a severance.
In your habeas petition, did you go ahead and get the transcript and show why that's not correct?
Oh, of course. That's in the transcript, and I can, if I may, I can direct you to it.
Sure.
Okay, this is the Broderick Cross at A609.
We're looking at Hugh Willow's excerpt 609?
The appendix. That's the appellant's appendix at 609.
And you're reading from your brief. What page on, are you on?
On my brief, I'm arguing on page 22.
What is the import of this?
That Sarah, without any independent source, was limited in his cross-examination of Broderick.
Well, this is, I thought what Judge Silverman was asking about was what evidence was there that Sarah could have and what perhaps would have brought out if it were not for the conflict. And you were referring us to the transcript of the in-camera hearing. But you're referring us, it looks like, to the part of the trial where Sarah cross-examines the FBI agent.
I think to, I respectfully, Your Honor, I believe this puts the appellant in an almost impossible position, and I'm quoting from this court from Allen.
Well, I take it then
can't put your finger on what the attorney could have or should have done, especially.
You can't tell us what informant A would have said.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Well, that's correct.
My understanding of the argument in your brief is that you're thinking that informant A would have said that Flowers had a separate supplier in Los Angeles, separate from your client, correct?
Yes.
But the only information I've got that's in the record that I've got that's relevant to that is on page 34 of Agent Broderick's affidavit. I'm on excerpts of record A601. The last full paragraph toward the bottom of that page that begins informant A further. I'll wait till you get there.
And the fact remains, right.
Okay, so just read along with me. It's a short paragraph. This is Broderick's affidavit describing what informant A has to say about supplier or suppliers in Los Angeles. Informant A further stated that Emmanuel Lacey has run into trouble with his source of cocaine and is only managing to sell ounces of cocaine along with heroin. He stated that Flowers is a separate supplier of cocaine from Los Angeles, supplying him in kilogram quantities. Well, that doesn't mean separate from Fiorillo. That means separate from Lacey's supplier.
Yes, except that if you go through the entire trial transcript, if you go through the pre-sentence report, there is no nexus whatsoever between Fiorillo and Los Angeles. Fiorillo is up in San Jose. Fiorillo comes down as far as Oakland, maybe. But there is nothing that connects him to Los Angeles.
Well, I guess we'll find out.
And since Sarah doesn't...
I'm confused here about what you're saying Sarah would have done if he didn't have a conflict. You're saying he would have asked the FBI agent, Broderick, even though he didn't know the answer, who was the Los Angeles supplier?
Sarah could have pressed him on who the Los Angeles
you
supplier
pressed,
is.
Do you mean asked?
Asked, yes. Yes, Your Honor.
In trial.
And
in trial,
had
without knowing the answer.
Well, let's put it this way.
And if he asks, he can't object when the FBI agent says, all indications point to your client.
If Broderick already has said at trial that Fiorillo was Sarah's supplier of cocaine, he says that.
Wait, if Broderick
testifies to that.
He testified.
Right. He testifies
to that. But now we're getting to the Los Angeles supplier.
We haven't gotten to Los Angeles yet.
Informant A has no personal knowledge.
Right. Now.
So he's not a competent witness.
Broderick, Sarah then doesn't ask him if he knows anything about informant A in the affidavit. If he asks him about informant A, he's going to ask him who informant A
identified. Why would he ask about informant A?
He's asking who the identity of informant
Counsel,
A was.
Why would he ask him about informant A, even if he knew informant A's name? It seems to me if informant A has no personal knowledge, he's not a percipient witness, then all he's good for is to the police as a tipster. I don't see where he helps Flowers' case or Fiorillo's case.
Since Sarah never, even after the trial, had the record unsealed, which he was able to do, but didn't do, since Sarah never presses Broderick on the point, the only thing we have.
You represent Fiorillo after the trial. You can obtain the record. So what's in there that shows what Sarah
because that, but by then the issue had already been decided on appeal. There was no way to bring it in as anything collateral. It was over.
I thought this is collateral.
No, but this wasn't collateral. Why is this collateral? This is part of the record.
Wait, you're saying, yeah, couldn't get it during trial because it was secret.
Oh, in camera.
But after trial, he could have gotten it. So I'm thinking, so you could have gotten it.
Well, I could only get it if the judge orders a hearing. And that's really my next point. The judge dismisses the whole thing without a hearing. There is no hearing. Sarah, who fills out interrogatory.
So what have you got now that you've had all this time to get what Sarah missed? What have you got?
What I have is a denial of a hearing, which would have permitted me to issue a subpoena under the hearing to get the rest of the information. But I didn't get a hearing, so I couldn't get that. If there was no hearing, how am I going to get it?
You have to show that you've got something.
Sure.
Something colorable to get to a hearing.
But if I have informant A, and I have Sarah.
I don't see what anyone in the Flowers gang would want informant A for, except to kill him, maybe. He's not a percipient witness. He can't testify at anything important.
It's interesting that Sarah, in his interrogatories, which, by the way, he answers while he is under awaiting sentence himself, but Sarah, in his interrogatories, doesn't remember if he ever discussed the issue of severance. He doesn't remember if he knew who informant A was, if he knew who the supplier was.
Let me ask you something concrete. Is there anything in the record to show that Fiorillo would have snitched Flowers out or that any deal was ever offered to him to snitch Flowers out for a break?
No, Your Honor.
That's usually what you want a separate lawyer for who has no divided loyalties.
No, Your Honor. There is not. There is not. I would like to talk about a hearing for just a moment, if I can. The judge relied on, Judge Quackenbush relied on Sarah's interrogatories and his answer that he would never compromise a client. And that he remembered, that he would never compromise a client. This is what he doesn't remember. He doesn't remember if he learned during the course of his representation of Flowers if Flower had a separate cocaine dealer. He doesn't remember if he decided that he wouldn't move for severance. And whether or not, I mean, this court, Judge Quackenbush granted a mistrial at one point. Judge Quackenbush might well have granted a severance if he could have made a colorable claim. But he never said that he was going to move for severance because he couldn't have examined Flowers without revealing confidential information. He never says that. And the argument is right there from Alberni, this court's decision in Alberni. There it was remanded for an evidentiary hearing. Here, the court applied a more permissive standard, holding that once an actual conflict is shown, you can presume prejudice. And here there is an alternative defense strategy, Your Honor. He could have moved for severance.
Well, I'm trying to follow this in your brief, and I can't find the pages where you argue that you should have been given a hearing.
In the brief, it's on pages I think, 20 to 23 on my brief.
Thanks.
I believe. Hold on. 21. Second, Your Honor.
No.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Let me just, you just give me 1 second, I will find it. 27. I know on my reply, I have it.
I want it in the blue brief.
In the blue brief?
That's where you have to raise issues.
Well, it's here. It's in the...
I'm not prepared on this issue, and I'm thinking, how could I have overlooked it? And I can't find it in the brief.
I will find it, Your Honor. I'm sorry.
Thank you, counsel.
My apologies. Well,
your time is up now, so when you we'll give you 30 seconds for rebuttal
seconds,
like everybody else and give us pages.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel?
May it please the Court, my name is Mary Jean Chan, and I represent the United States in this appeal. I think Judge Kleinfeld, as well as the other judges on this panel, have put your fingers on the issue here, which is that there's nothing in the facts that have been proffered by Mr. Fiorello or anybody else that support this notion that Mr. Serra, his trial attorney, ever actively represented any conflicting interests. That is, there was ever any actual conflict. And that is the constitutional predicate for the ineffective assistance of counsel claim. With respect to the point that Ms. Edwards was raising about the tapes showing informant A being a supplier, an alternate supplier in L.A., and that there being no connection drawn of Mr. Fiorello to L.A., that's simply not true. If you refer to the excerpts of the government at 155, for example, which is the closing argument made by the prosecutor in this case, it's very clear that what the government's case showed was that there were phone calls between Mr. Flowers and Mr. Fiorello, and that after that, Mr. Hermanek would be communicated to by Mr. Fiorello, at which point Mr. Hermanek would go down to L.A. and get the cocaine and then come back. After he came back to the Bay Area, he would then talk to Mr. Fiorello, and Mr. Fiorello would then talk to Mr. Flowers. So there was a connection to L.A. So the record actually shows that there is a connection between Mr. Fiorello and L.A. But going back again to the main point, which is just that Mr. Fiorello has never shown any actual conflict. In fact, Mr. Fiorello and Mr. Flowers held a coordinated defense. It was essentially a joint defense.
This is the closing argument you just referred to.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I don't have the exact citation to what that refers to within the transcript. If Your Honor would like it, I could try to dig that up after the argument. But there is a link between L.A. and Mr. Fiorello is the point I wanted to make.
The idea is that Fiorello was the L.A. supplier in the sense that Flowers would call Fiorello. Fiorello would send Hermanek down to L.A. to pick up the drugs, and then Hermanek would come back with the drugs from somebody in L.A.
I don't know who the supplier in L.A. was, but the idea is that because there was this L.A. connection, it very well might have been related to Mr. Fiorello. So if we had been able to call informant A or been able to probe that, that might have simply strengthened the connection of Mr. Fiorello to the cocaine charges.
But your argument, and you've got evidence to support, is that Fiorello sends Hermanek down to Los Angeles. Hermanek comes back up with cocaine. Where Hermanek gets it, I guess we don't quite know.
I don't know.
Oh, you mean Flowers didn't turn state's evidence and tell you?
No, Your Honor. So as I was saying before, Mr. Flowers and Mr. Fiorello had a coordinated defense. Both of them claimed that they had no connection to cocaine, that what they were involved in was steroids and marijuana. Now, this defense was an obvious and logical and probably the strongest defense that Mr. Serra could have come up with for Mr. Fiorello in light of the government's evidence, which was numerous tapes, incriminating calls, having Mr. Fiorello and Mr. Flowers on the phone together talking about some substance. So to the extent that Mr. Fiorello pointed the finger at Mr. Flowers and said, look, this guy is intimately connected with cocaine, that would have incriminated him as well. So the idea is...
And I think this would have been inconsistent with the defense they presented. They basically had to choose one or the other. Either Flowers had a cocaine supplier in Los Angeles who wasn't Mr. Fiorillo, or they weren't dealing with cocaine at all. So they decided, listen, we're just not going to be dealing with cocaine at all. But if that's true, maybe there's a problem for you. That is, Flowers couldn't say simultaneously, well, I wasn't dealing with cocaine, but I had a separate supplier. Fiorillo could say, well, I wasn't dealing with cocaine, I was just dealing with steroids. But Flowers, he had a separate, he was dealing some cocaine, and that was a totally separate deal. He had a separate supplier for that.
Well,
why couldn't Sarah have made that defense as a plausible defense?
I don't think that would have been a plausible defense because the evidence, as I said before, between the two of them was so intimately connected. So you have the two of them on the phone talking about some illegal substance.
So you're saying the joint defense was to say whatever substance they're talking about on the phone, it's not cocaine, which is the only substance they're charged with.
That's
and
correct.
If he'd said, well, I'm not, but Flowers is a cocaine dealer, then it would have suggested a possible inference that when they talked on the phone, it was about steroids, but Flowers separately was a cocaine dealer.
I don't think it's not an obvious defense, right? I think that
or it could have meant what they were talking about on the phone was cocaine for
correct.
Both of them.
I think what Judge
incidentally, how would you? Did anyone testify? Did any of the accused conspirators testify?
No, Judge Kleinfeld, and I think that's a good point. So
it's hard to say. What you were doing and what other people are doing if you don't say anything.
Well, I was going to say that the point of that is that there's no conflict there because one of the main ways that there would be a conflict for Mr. Serra is if, let's say, Mr. Flowers or Mr. Fiorillo testified and he had to cross-examine one or the other. And none of them testified. As in Lightborn, where you had a husband and wife, which is somewhat different, but you had a group of people who were charged with conspiracy who decided to be loyal together to hold a coordinated defense, they then waived their right to conflict-free counsel, and that's exactly what happened here. In fact, both Mr. Flowers and Mr. Fiorillo unequivocally waived their right to conflict-free counsel. Mr. Fiorillo did that in order to retain services of his counsel of choice, Mr. Serra, and he did this both under the advisement of Mr. Serra, who advised him of the different potential conflicts, as well as Judge Smith, in district court. There was a colloquy. He did this willingly, and as in Martinez, where this court says, once you've done that, if you have a valid waiver, you're not free later on when it's strategically advantageous to renege on that. And that's really what he's trying to do. So we do have a waiver where he unequivocally says, whatever the conflicts there are, I waive them. And in fact, he didn't anticipate any real conflicts coming up because he had a joint defense. So because their interests were really aligned, there was really no occasion for Mr.
Well, but that's the whole
yes.
question. You say they're aligned, but maybe they weren't. And if there truly is some conflict, if it truly is the case, for example, that Tony Serra knows that Flowers does have a cocaine supplier down in Los Angeles who is not connected to Fiorillo, well, then there's a fatal conflict.
Well, I would...
How are we so sure of that? That we can just say, oh, go away, you're done.
Your Honor, I think that there's a burden upon Mr. Fiorillo, first of all, to provide some facts. And here he hasn't provided anything. There's some speculation. And it isn't even as though Mr. Fiorillo has said Mr. Serra does know who this identity of this person is. His counsel has said it's possible, and Mr. Serra may well have learned this identity during his representation. He hasn't proffered any facts that would allow us to get to the point where we have an evidentiary hearing.
What are we supposed to do with Mr. Serra's answers to all these questions, which consist of, they start out to be, I don't know, but pretty soon, I don't know gets so boring to write that they just turn into ditto marks. I mean, he has an extraordinary memory, that is to say, extraordinary non-memory.
Well, it was 10 years ago.
He can hardly even remember the guy's name.
It was 10 years ago, and he does, as he said, try cases back to back.
I can remember page numbers that I cross-examined doctors about from 20 years ago.
Would we all have that memory?
Let's say most judges would think Sarah was not telling the truth about just how vacant his memory was.
The district court didn't actively rely on the interrogatories. That's the first thing I want to make a note of. Secondly, under Williams versus Woodford, he had the discretion to expand the record only by interrogatories. Thirdly, we never have the defendant making his burden for an evidentiary hearing by putting any facts in dispute.
Could Fiorillo in this proceeding have taken a deposition of Sarah or sought access to the in-camera hearing from before the trial?
I don't see why not. I mean, he had every opportunity to put forward some declaration, some facts. He had all this opportunity. He never took it. And I wanted to return briefly to Judge Fletcher's point, too, about what if this were true? What if he knew something?
Well, you could make mincemeat of the guy.
Pardon?
Who were you married to 10 years ago? I don't remember.
Oh, no, not.
Were you in jail or out of jail 10 years ago? I don't remember.
That's actually not the point that I was referring to. The point was that, let's say Mr. Sarah did know something from his prior representation. Would Mr. Fiorillo therefore be entitled to that as part of his Sixth Amendment? And no, he is not. The point is that Mr. Fiorillo is entitled to assistance of counsel who is conflict-free. He waived that. But he's not entitled to the benefit of a conflicted counsel, which is really what he's arguing here. No other attorney would have known anything about Mr. Flower Supplier.
Let me ask you a little flip side of that. You're saying he's not entitled to the benefit of being able to use confidential communications from Flowers to Sarah in a previous case because nobody who wasn't conflicted would have had those confidential communications.
That's correct,
Okay. I was wondering about another thing. Suppose the judge, I think it was Judge Smith, at the hearing said, boy, I'm just not satisfied, and I look at these interrogatories and they look phony to me, the answers to interrogatories. I guess she didn't see the answers to interrogatories.
This is actually Judge Quackenbush at this point.
But let me back up to Smith. Suppose she had not been satisfied with Sarah's answers at that hearing. I think he talked about how he was hungry for lunch.
I'm sorry?
I think Sarah talked about how he was hungry for lunch when Judge Fern Smith questioned him at her hearing before the trial.
He has a flippant style, yes.
If she had said, I think there is a conflict of interest here that cannot be waived, would that mean that even though Fiorillo had said, I want Tony Sarah as my lawyer, the judge would have said, no, you can't have Tony Sarah as your lawyer. You have to get some lawyer other than the one you want. Is that what we're talking about?
If she had made a finding that the possibility of the conflict was not remote, that it was highly likely to manifest, and that it would violate Mr. Fiorillo's Sixth Amendment rights, I think it would have been within her discretion to do that. But the cases in which that has
is
really...
Is that the remedy if there is an insufficiently waived potential conflict? Make the defendant get a different lawyer?
Yes. Yes. And in fact, in the Allen case, I believe it was, this Ninth Circuit also said that because they actually found that the waiver in that case was not sufficient. They found that there was a conflict initially, but then the conflicted counsel had been substituted by independent counsel, I think a person named Cullen. And because of that, the court said, we find that he's had all the remedy that he really would have been entitled to.
I'm trying to think, when we look back at it in a post-conviction relief proceeding,
yes,
are we looking at a kind of Scylla and Charybdis? The judge violates the defendant's rights by depriving him of the lawyer of his choice. If the judge says the lawyer's conflicted out erroneously, and the judge violates the defendant's constitutional right to an unconflicted lawyer if she does not order the lawyer out of the case and it's erroneous?
Well, the judge has to have some reason for finding it to be an actual conflict or that the conflict is very likely, and that's not the case we had here. In fact, there was no actual conflict.
If the judge errs in either direction, it's a constitutional violation?
If the judge errs by saying that there is a high likelihood and deprives the defendant of, then, the, yes, the defendant is deprived of his choice of counsel. And but I think it's less so the other way. I mean, as with the Ferretta context, you can waive your right to I guess, effective counsel by if you are knowing and voluntary about it. And I think in some ways that might be analogous to this situation. So he, in any case, Mr. Fiorillo really took on the risk to himself. And I think it was a very small risk.
Does our standard for reviewing that give, I can't remember exactly how we do this, and I can't remember whether there's any room for us to accord some discretion to the trial judge who has to make that decision?
The trial court does have discretion, yes. There's quite a lot of discretion. But also the case law that's really been dealing with this area talks a lot about Rule 44, and usually that is a multiple representation case where you have an attorney simultaneously representing two clients, let's say, or a client and a witness, both identical at the same time. Here you have a successive representation situation, which the Supreme Court has explicitly said has much less potential for these kinds of conflicts or for actual conflicts. And I think it's clear in this case that this is an example of why they would say that.
Cases like this must come up all the time with state public defenders because, when I did criminal defense, a lot of them lived in the same apartment. I still remember their apartment number. You get the same crowd in all the time. But I didn't notice any precedents just directly in point on a successive representation case like this.
In what respect, Your Honor?
Some Supreme Court decision saying how Kyler versus Sullivan applies to a successive representation case that's factually pretty much on all fours with this.
A Supreme Court case, I don't think that there has been one, but I think, with respect to the actual conflict, we have cases in the Ninth Circuit that are instructive. So, for example, in the Fitzpatrick case, you had a situation where the defendant didn't blame his co-defendant, even though it was a successive situation. And in that situation, this circuit said, well, there was a conflict because the obvious defense would have been to blame this other person, and it wasn't taken. It's very different than in this case because we have people in the same trial in a conspiracy where that kind of blame shifting would have most likely backfired. So the standard is that Mr. Fiorillo has to show that Mr. Serra failed to take some viable alternative trial strategy, not some theoretically possible strategy, but something that would have made sense within the context, the factual context of this case.
Usually
and he
what
hasn't.
You show is the way you actually do get a break in dope conspiracies is snitch somebody out.
And as Your Honor pointed out before, there's no showing that Mr. Fiorillo wanted to do that. He could have put out a declaration saying, you know, I told Mr. Serra I want to snitch this person out. I think that we're totally in different boats. Nothing of the sort. There's nothing that says that he would have wanted to point the finger at him or do anything. So there's no conflict. This is completely speculative, and there really is no actual conflict, which, as I started off with, is the constitutional predicate.
Let me ask you this. Is there in existence a tape or a transcript of the hearing before then-Magistrate Judge Hamilton? Does such a tape or transcript exist?
I believe there does because I think what happened was that after Magistrate Hamilton had reviewed it and come up with her recommendation, Judge Smith then reviewed that and agreed that there was no basis.
Have you listened to that tape or seen that transcript?
I have not.
Why not?
I think it's still sealed, and I didn't go to look for it. I didn't realize that it would be an issue.
It seems to me that...
But does it matter? I mean, isn't there a burden to come forward with it?
Yes.
I mean, if there's a smoking gun, that's where it's likely to be. That is to say, the whole issue really, as I get it, comes down to, did Tony Serra have some knowledge or some strong reason to suspect that there was a separate supplier of cocaine down there in Los Angeles, which would mean that Flowers was a cocaine dealer, he had his own supplier, and that Fiorillo was just doing marijuana and steroids. And that tape, which is the tape of the transcript with informant A, well, it's either on that tape or it's not. And if it's not, I think then Tony Serra's probably not conflicted. If it's there, well, then he is.
Well, the district court, I didn't listen to it, but the district court did, as well as did the magistrate judge. And they didn't find that there was any information.
Yeah, but they did back at the trial time. Nobody did it. Nobody's done it on habeas. Is that correct?
As far as I know, nobody has looked at it on habeas. But
that's right. And when Magistrate Judge Hamilton, now District Judge Hamilton,
yes,
heard it, and when Judge Smith reviewed it, they had what they thought was a waiver. This is any waiver of conflict. So they weren't, I don't know if they were listening to that for purposes of determining whether or not Tony Serra was pulling his punches in his defense.
They weren't looking at it in this context, but they were listening to it in the context of Mr. Serra making requests to find out the identity of this informant A, and whether, and specifically Mr. Serra asked, did he provide the name of an informant, and did the informant A provide the name of his source or the name of that particular person?
Right.
And it wasn't. So yeah. The district court, we would
and they were listening, and they were listening, they were hearing that, they held that hearing at the request of Mr. Serra.
They did.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's really no reason for us to speculate that Mr. Serra was doing this as a charade, which is really what you would have to accept, this proposition that Mr. Serra made these inquiries in order to come up with some front to provide knowledge that he actually knew. I mean, it's very, very circuitous. Your Honors, I see I've run out of time, and I wanted just to briefly respond to Ms. Edwards' remarks on the sentencing. Unless this court is inclined to expand the certificate of appealability on this and find that Carrington really doesn't apply to this situation, and that even though Cruz and Carrington both specifically say that Booker is not retroactively applicable to collateral appeals, then I won't really speak on that. But I would say simply that given Mr. Fiorillo's unequivocal waiver, given that there's been no showing of any actual fact, even to warrant going to an evidentiary hearing on either this conflict having to do with prior representation of Flowers or Mr. Serra's tax violations, the government would ask this court to affirm.
Thank you.
And may I just very, very briefly, page 23, and that is where I say that there is no the interrogatories are not an excuse for a substitute for a hearing. The fact that they decided on a coordinated defense, that was the only defense that they could have given Sarah's particular conflict. And when we talk about the waiver, this is what was represented to the defendants at waiver, and I'm quoting, and this is page 6 and 7 of the brief, and it's from our appendix 576. There's no information gathered from any of these past representations that in any way hurts or damages present clients in any matter. Defendants understand there's an appearance of conflict created simply by the past attorney-client relationship. This is what the clients heard when they waived. And they said, well, that sounds fine. What Fiorillo didn't hear is that while Serra is representing Flowers, Flowers is supposed to be, according to the government, a major, major dealer in cocaine. And then we find the separate hearing, the separate source from informant A. And it makes sense that he would try hard.
But your evidence of separate source is the Broderick affidavit?
Is the Broderick affidavit.
Is that the language that I just read you?
Yeah, that's correct.
But that language says to me quite unmistakably that separate means separate from Lacey rather than separate from Fiorillo.
Now, on page A493 and 494, which is the 2255 motion, we specifically request a right to conduct an evidentiary hearing, and we specifically request the right to subpoena documents for that hearing. We were denied that by the court. If we had a hearing, we would have subpoenaed the document. The only thing I was able to get from the court were some tapes. That was the only thing, and that took almost 8 months of struggling.
You say some tapes. Tapes of what?
Taped conversations between Flowers and Fiorillo, to examine the originals.
We're making a motion to get a copy of the transcript of the tape.
I believe that was done, oh, gosh, all the way back. That was done by a sort of a letter motion, I think so. I think, Your Honor, but I don't want to make that representation.
You made a motion to get the magistrate judge transcript?
Your Honor, I don't recall. I really don't recall, Your Honor.
Okay.
I don't want to misrepresent that to the court.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
United States versus Fiorillo is submitted. We are adjourned for the day.